Having concluded with the group of students in London a paragraph by paragraph study of Science and Health's 8th chapter, Footsteps of Truth, Gordon Brown attempts on this tape to summarize the essential ideas that the study has brought to light. As in the case of the 7 preceding chapters, the detail of the text has been considered within the setting of the chapter as a whole, and from the standpoint of the system of capitalized, synonymous terms for God, which permeate the book and determine its spiritually scientific meaning.
This is one of the textbook's longer chapters, 53 pages in all. It will not be possible, therefore, in the space of this recording to touch on every paragraph or for thought to flow from each capitalized term to the next, as it has in the case of some of the shorter chapters. Nevertheless, none of the ideas that come to light must be thought of as extracted selectively from the context as a whole. This summary is the outcome of the original study, when the rule of continuity and wholeness of taking nothing out of context was strictly adhered to and obeyed. So, the textbook's 8th chapter. If the sequence of the chapters so far was related symbolically to the scale in music, we would say that this is where we sound the octave. The first 7 notes, the first 7 chapters, having led to this note, this chapter, the scale begins over again an octave higher. It's as if the first 7 chapters are gathered into a grand epitome of their spiritual meaning, and we are now living what we have been taught. Hence the feeling at once of all things becoming new, of our having been given foundations on which to build safely a new spiritual life. Merging from chapter 7 then to chapter 8, or from page 200 to page 201, Jesus Christ and Him crucified has led to Jesus Christ and Him glorified. Ideally, we are working from this glorified resurrection standpoint, the standpoint of Christian Science itself. Christian Science in its absoluteness. What the textbook has been teaching us from the beginning is manifesting itself now in our lives. Resurrection and new birth are the same. In the measure, therefore, that this actual new birth is established in the 8th chapter, then in the 9th, a totally new sense of creation is won. Take the verse from Psalm 89 on which the chapter as a whole is based. The footsteps there of God's anointed are, of course, the footsteps of David, God's well-beloved, whose throne he has promised shall be established forever. The kingship of David typifies the eternal kingship of Christ or truth. But the anointed's footsteps are reproached by the mighty people, that is to say, by thought that adheres to a material way of life. This word reproach is used in the Bible substantially with reference to barrenness. God hath taken away my reproach, says the hitherto barren Rachel, when Joseph is born. And so it is with many of the mothers of the advancing spiritual idea in the Bible. This day have I rolled away the reproach of Egypt from off you, God says to the newly circumcised Israel nation as they prepare to accept love's spiritual endowment, their own promised land. Therefore the name of the place is called Gilgal, says the Bible, which is the same as Galilee, meaning circle. As Jesus showed, man comes from God and goes back to God. He's the reflection of God. At the point of the eighth chapter, then, our thought is increasingly uncircumscribed by the false physiological and biological beliefs analyzed in the seventh chapter. Hence the new sense of creativity and of creation that comes as the ninth chapter. It was the Egyptian bondwoman Hagar who had reproached Sarah, the wife of Abraham, for her barrenness and who had herself borne Abraham a son. The reproach of Egypt, which must be rolled from our thought, is the circumscribing belief that spirit has to work through the mediumship of matter in order to be productive. In the promised land, spirituality itself is fruitful and no longer apparently barren. It brings forth from within itself, irrespective of matter and material organization. Hence the standpoint of resurrection and newness of life, which is the underlying theme of this chapter. The Christian perfection, which we are told at the foot of the opening page there, page 201, must be won, is represented on the closing page, that's page 254, as having been won. The divine demand, "Be ye therefore perfect," is scientific, says the text at the end of the chapter. And the human footsteps leading to perfection are indispensable. So Jesus taught, "No man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man which is in heaven." The human footsteps leading to perfection are really the return journey of the footsteps that lead out first from perfection. Like those of the anointed, they are truth's own footsteps coming from and returning to truth. By the time we enter the eighth chapter, the belief of taking personal human footsteps of our own has been nailed to the cross, as we find it at the close of the seventh chapter. So the significance of footsteps of truth is that having been founded on the idea of resurrection and rebirth in the course of the first seven chapters, we work from this standpoint from the beginning in order to reach it in the end. Now, glancing down page 201, if we cannot build safely on false foundations, there on line 7, which is really the physiological tree of mortality, then we can build safely on the true foundations of the tree of resurrection and life. According to the capitalized terms used in these opening paragraphs, this means building on foundations of truth, lines 1 and 7, and love, line 18. In this case, truth makes us a new creature, in whom the old things of physiology, sensuality, death, and so on pass away, and all things become new, resurrected, glorified. One supreme affection guides our lives, and we no longer try to serve two masters. The reproach of Egypt rolls away. Truth, practiced and demonstrated, is the only thing that is permitted to preach. The vessels of mortal mind, full of the false knowledge discussed in the previous chapter, have to be emptied, the error extracted and replaced by truth, little t, in the form of flood tides of love, capital L. Our one affection must henceforth be nothing less than universal love, capital L. So the opening chord of the chapter is truth and love. Anticipated, we remember back there on page 192, it was line 27, where we were told to walk in the footsteps of truth and love by following the example of our master in the understanding of divine metaphysics. Then said the text, whatever holds human thought in line with unselfed love, truth and love are only real self, receives directly the divine power. In no other way than by following, that is, understanding, modeling our lives in accordance with this Christ ideal of truth and love, do we win Christian perfection. Line 2201, the holiness of these new things, whereby we make this new start in life and all things become new, cannot be grafted onto the old unholiness. So over to 202, line 3, where these new and safe foundations from which to advance are described as the scientific unity which exists between God and man, which must be wrought out in life practice, so that God's will is universally done. The insistence throughout the chapter is undoubtedly this life practice. Now this involves, in the marginal heading there, divine study. Study of the science of mind that redeems no less than the whole human family. God's will universally done. Having this as our goal determines the divinity of our study. It involves the merits of Christ or the acceptance of truth. Accepting in science, on behalf of all mankind, the one Christ mind, truth, the mind of all men. Only through studying divinely, accepting from truth what truth really is, do we, line 14, spiritually understand Christian science. Now naturally, this takes place inside of science, where everything is immutable, not outside, where all is in a state of mutation and change. In this true earthly experience of ours, we find the divine principle of our being, in accordance with which we neither sin, suffer, nor die. We're treading the true way of life, line 20 there, not the way of death. Truth, with its infinite capacities for dominion over all the earth, is opening up before us. The principle of our being, little b, line 6, is the one supreme being, capital B, line 24, namely truth itself, almighty in power, because omnipotent spirit, not senseless matter. This power of truth becomes to us then the law of love. This power of spirit becomes to us the law of love, as this obtains in the science of Christianity. That's page 203, lines 2 and 3. Only in the science of Christianity, with its law of love, do we truly find spirit. Do we truly do good? Are we truly Christian? Do we emulate the godlike spirit, little s, of self-abnegation, line 13? With the science of Christianity for our mind, then, like Jesus, we make ourselves the Son of God. How? Why? Because mind itself is our maker, and we are its image, indeed, and in truth, little t. The human is not operating independently outside the divine. So this mind is the supreme ruler, line 17, of its own body, which is man. Mind is never imprisoned in a sensuous mortal body. It is thus man's deathless principle, his sinless soul, and therefore his timeless life. Now, at the bottom of 203, note the capitalization. God, who is our life, little l, gives us eternal life, capital L. God, who is both capital life and uncapital life, is therefore at once the center and circumference of our being. Over to page 204. So that the teaching on page 204 sounds again the note which is basic to the chapter as a whole, namely the idea of only one, not more than one, not more than one life, line 4, not two separate powers, spirit and matter, but only one spirit. No mortal man, therefore. For mortal man comes from the supposed mixture of spirit and matter and constitutes a third power. Humanity in this chapter is resurrected from this old sense of man as a mortal mixture of opposites. So, line 21, only one God, one mind or intelligence, which in science is the ego of everything. Therefore, man has not got a mind of his own distinct from the all mind. A real mind is mind, capital M, which does not live pantheistically in matter any more than soul lives in body. It is in soul, spirit, not matter, that we find the body of mind. Mind that has created all things perfect. Whence then, the question is asked, is it necessary, 205, line 14, for sexual recreation and procreation? So in the paragraph beginning line 22, one mind, one God, in contrast to many ruling minds. One mind only constitutes the law whereby we love our neighbor unselfishly as our self. Man and his neighbor have one and the same mind, which is therefore the self of both. Having one mind instead of minds in the plural, we throw all our weight into the scale of spirit and none into the scale of matter. What we're doing, line 32 at the bottom there, is understand more and more fully our relation to the divine, capital D. That is the scientific unity which exists between God and man as we had it back there on page 202 at the top. This is the relation of the uncapitalized terms to the capitalized, such as life, little l, to life, capital L, which we had a moment ago, both of them together being God. In this case, we have no other mind, love, wisdom, truth, or life but his, God's. Our relation to the divine, capital T, capital D, is that our only real mind is the one God mind. Same with our love, our truth, and with our life. Having his mind, we certainly are his body. And in the measure that this is so, the human will is in subordination to truth. That is to say, the will of a part is always the will of the whole. Then, the sentiments of hope, faith, and love are governed by science. In man's relation to the divine, which is clearly included in the scientific relation of God to man, spirit is man's inexhaustible source of supply. As shown in the case of the loaves and fishes, that's line 17, one and all being equally blessed. When our mind is one, this clearly is the mind of all. Because in God's finished work, all are inseparable from one and one from all. Birth and death are unreal. Marginal heading. The one mind made all and includes all. 9:28 there. Mind does not make a mistake, such as a child being supposedly taken away from God at birth and subsequently correct this mistake by taking the child back again at death. There are no such things, therefore, as spirits in the plural, evil or otherwise. There is only Spirit, capital S. Evil disappears from our lives when we awake to the fact that we never disappeared from spirit. And notice the term spirit used here again in conjunction with Christianity. In Christianity, page 207, 6, statement and proof are one. Man in Christianity is the reflection of spirit. He comes from spirit as the statement, the idea of spirit, what I, spirit, am, and returns to spirit in proof of the fact that spirit alone is. Spirit being mind, line 9, mind, the Creator does not create an evil mind. The law of spirit, line 12, in contrast to so-called laws of matter, is the law of reflection, in which man does not leave mind in the first place and return to it in the second. And here we touch the divine principle of man, line 14, his perfect Father, the creative mind of whom man never loses sight. Realizing this, we live in soul, not mortal body. And this is the science of our being, in which the amalgamation of truth and error in cause and effect is impossible. So the keynote is still the one. Marginal heading, line 22, one, primal cause, the cause of every effect. Therefore, no sin, sickness, disease, or death in the science of man's being. Rather, this science is constituted of truth, life, love. Neither truth, life, nor love are absent from the science of being. Truth, whole, life, indivisible, love, all-inclusive and universal, is the scientific fact in all things, constituting the harmonious action of man and the whole universe as the ideal of truth. So 208, line 5, the science, the truth, life, love of our being is therefore that in him, spirit, we live and move and have our being. We are finding the body in which we truly dwell, where there is no independent power, no law of mortal mind, only the spiritual law of the mind, which is truth, line 11, and therefore is spirit, line 15, because no matter is there, either to cause or cure disease. Line 17, God is not really the father of mind. God is the one father mind. The science of which we are learning and the way for which we are preparing. Science, the reign of spirit, the kingdom of universal harmony, is body as it really is. A material body, line 25, expresses a material mortal mind. Mortal man who possesses this body makes it harmonious or discordant according to the thoughts he impresses on it. Mortal man embraces his body in his thought, whereas true body expresses mind as its cause. Mind possesses and embraces in itself its own body, man. And so it is that on 209.5, mind governs supremely all the formations that make up its body as a system of ideas. The body, man, and the universe is tributary to this mind. Science reveals that mind, supreme intelligence, holds its world, its body, in its grasp. Hence the world doesn't collapse. This world, this earth, this universe, this body of mind is, on line 29, the infinite calculus of spirit, swallowing up in spiritual translation in the margin there, the material sense of itself. That is the sense of all the compounded minerals or aggregated substances composing the earth, the relations which constituent masses hold to each other, astronomical calculations and all the paraphernalia of speculative theories based on the hypothesis of material law, life and intelligence resident in matter. The calculus of spirit is the moving, flowing harmony of the universe and therefore of body as it is in science. The living calculus of all mind's formations. So what is being developed through these and subsequent pages then is the true idea of mind's formations testified to by spiritual sense. Because the next main topic in the chapter is spiritual sense. The sense of the universe as spirit. 209.31 defines spiritual sense as the conscious, constant capacity to understand God. To this end, the system of ideas, back on line 6, constituting the universe. Now over to page 210, are expressed for us in new tongues, are translated into a language which human thought can comprehend for the purpose of translating everything back into the calculus of spirit. And this, of course, accords with the happenings on the day of Pentecost, which we read about in the New Testament. Spiritual sense discerns the principle and proof of Christianity, where only proof really states the principle, revealing the spiritual relationships that make up Christianity, that is, the whole human race as one Christ body. So we have soul and its attributes, line 11. soul and its own inherent qualities, its senses, manifested through man. And therefore, translating the faculties, the senses of seeing, hearing, and so on, into its own spiritual senses. Because soul is mind, line 15, mind acts upon human minds and bodies. Soul, mind, minds and bodies, bringing them salvation from mortality. Because mind is immortal and is spirit, mortal mind is a solecism, self-destroying, sowing the wind, the opposite of spirit, and reaping the whirlwind. Mortal mind, unintelligent, mindless matter in the marginal heading, and mortal sense are the negative concepts in these paragraphs, which are reversed, of course, by immortal mind, spirit, soul. The dictionary says that sense, the senses, sensation, sensitivity, etc., all associated with mortal body, are to do with the capacity of an organism to respond to stimulation and receive impressions from external objects. The topic on page 211 is nerve sensations. But on the other hand, immortal spiritual sense is the sense, the feeling, the consciousness of nothing stimulating us from outside, but everything about us going on inside of mind, of spirit, soul. The bodily organs, 211.1, cannot really talk or report how they feel because matter is sensationless. Marginal heading line 9, and nerves are not mind, but mindless matter. Material sensation seems to obtain, therefore, in mortal mind. Line 11, the cause of all material effect. Whereas real feeling, awareness, and sensibility appear in the spiritual understanding of being. In science, line 23, the science of one mind, there is no sympathetic transference of thought from one erring mind, indeed one erring nerve, to another. Through dematerialization and spiritualization of thought, line 29, the body's faculties are found immortal in spirit, deathless, and therefore cannot be lost. Nerves supposedly activating the faculties are the source neither of pain or pleasure. Line 22, and this is the topic down the whole of page 212. So, the need at the bottom of page of 212 is to understand the methods of mind, capital M, regarding what is called the modus and action of all things. At the top of 213, as a man spiritually understandeth, not as he thinketh materially, so is he in truth. Immortal spiritual facts, line 8, exist apart from the mortal mind concept that things have to be classified either as liquid or solid. God, good, spirit, line 12, is self-existent. true idea behind the liquid concept of something having to be formed and brought into being and self-expressed. The true idea behind the formed or solid concept. Though indefinable as a whole, the wholeness of good is known, of course, only to God, good as a whole, to which we are being drawn or attracted humanly as we depart from paralyzing material theories and walk in the footsteps of goodness, the quality of God, good. So, continuing to deal with the senses, the text turns specifically to the sense of sound. 9:16. Sound is a mental impression made on mortal belief. Mental impression is part of the dictionary definition of idea. The material ear does not really hear. Divine science reveals sound as communicated through the senses of soul. So what are these senses of soul? They are spiritual understanding. Line 19. In accordance with the definition of ears in the glossary, spiritual understanding is what really hears. And such sound is true music, the reality behind the symbol of human music. This is the music which must be played on the harp of mortal mind in order to replace discord with harmony. Music is the rhythm of science and soul, of head and heart, that is, of letter and spirit, knowing and feeling, statement and proof, the opposite of human knowledge. Line 30 with its false sense of things. Mind is the source and origin, over now to page 214, of all truth's impressions, that is, its images, its ideas, and therefore of all true sound. The real medium of hearing is, as we found a moment ago, spiritual understanding, the senses of soul, in which perception, line 5, is not confined to the evidence before the material senses. Perceiving this, Enoch walked with God. He took humanly truth's divine footsteps in accordance with the teachings of this 8th chapter. In the marginal heading now, 2:14:11, is Adam and the senses. Adam's senses testifying to object and subject, divinity and humanity too, are the reverse of Enoch's senses, the sinless senses of soul, where they are one, ensuring the spiritual translation of the universe, all things returning to spirit where they came from, as discussed back there on page 209. Adam's senses coming from dust return to dust. Line 12. Spiritual sense carries the impressions, the sounds, the ideas of mind to man. Real sounds are impressions made on spiritual sense, on spiritual understanding, on the senses of soul, God's own senses, of which God cannot be robbed by material knowledge. So that man cannot be slain by the illusion that he has ever been lost from God. Therefore, the senses of soul, the marginal heading, line 28, the only real senses, the only real eyes and ears are faculties of soul, which soul can never lose, because being senses of spirit, they do not testify to something outside of spirit, but to everything being within, being the embodiment of soul. And this explains the harmony of all things. 215, line 2. The might and permanence of truth. No truth, little t, can ever depart from the all-inclusive wholeness of truth itself. So the second paragraph on 215, entitled Real Being Never Lost, is dominated by the term spirit, soul, mind, which cannot sin and whose faculties therefore cannot be lost. Third paragraph there. Whereas material vision is, by implication, subordinate to the limits of geographic altitudes, spiritual vision is not. Spiritual vision is never for an instant deprived of the light and might of intelligence and life, capital L. The light of life, which cannot be cut off from life, and of which therefore life can never be robbed, shines forth as truth, little t, and love, little l. On line 21, that is, as man. In this undividedness of God and man is seen the science of life. Socrates sensed this immortality of man, line 31, when he took the hemlock poison. He sensed that true body is found in soul, not material sense. So page 216, 3, life, God is not alive today and dead tomorrow, and therefore man isn't either. Man is truth, little t, not error. Error cannot kill truth, little t, by taking it away from truth, capital T. Therefore, truth, capital T, kills error. Truth in its wholeness lays open siege to materialism, that is to say, it surrounds it wholly, leaving error no way of escape. We're back, therefore, with the idea of but one. Truth, little t, is the understanding that there is but one mind or intelligence, on line 12 there, which is the ego of everything. This is what destroys error. The body of nerves, bones, brain, etc., is made harmonious because its reality is everlasting life and truth and love, the body of divine mind. There are not two bodies, a matter body and the body of spirit. There isn't Christ and Belial. So let us be absent from matter as body and present with and as the body of one mind, line 32, which this mind forms in its own likeness. This is science, 217 at the top, in which the loss of man's identity is impossible. Because mind is distinct from matter, mind conquers disease permanently on the grounds that none exists in the body of mind. This body is always at rest, never fatigued, is always showing forth the control and the power of mind. Neither mind, capital M, nor mindless matter can be weary or heavy laden. Over to 218, line 1, mortal mind affirms the weariness which it, mortal mind, makes. Because his mind, capital M, is forever conscious of itself as truth, man is never unconscious, never dreams that he is error instead of truth. And therefore, divine mind, 218, line 16, has jurisdiction over the body, including, of course, the mortal sense of body. And this means that mind is love, line 23, an ever-present help, an almighty power in times of moral and physical trouble. What we prove when we run or walk in the footsteps of truth is that mind is supreme, absolute, and final. 219.4, and that matter has neither intelligence, sensation, nor power. In fact, we must be as correct in science regarding mortal mind and divine mind as we would be in working out sums in mathematics. In science, we never affirm concerning the body what we do not wish it to manifest, line 14. In the same way, the science of music governs music. And here we touch the curative principle of metaphysical science, line 25, and begin to be immune from sin, suffering, and death. Over to 220, line 18, where we see how mortal mind charges its own phenomena to matter as something supposedly other than itself, like the kitten thinking it sees not itself in the mirror but another kitten. And now the topic changes to dietetics, taking up the subject of the previous chapter, the fruits of the physiological tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Mortal mind forms and controls all the conditions of the mortal body as directly as the will moves the hand. And the next two pages are all about the dyspeptic who suffered from eating this false knowledge, and who was saved by Christian science because being in science is sustained by mind. The truths he assimilated opened his eyes, which the serpent had supposedly closed, and disciplined by self-denial and divine science, where all truth is already digested anyway, he ate without suffering. So over to 222, line 22, no, line 7, 222, line 7. He learned that mortal mind makes a mortal body, whereas truth regenerates this fleshly mind and feeds thought with the bread of life. And this bread of life is truth, which mind already is. This bread supplied nutriment and strength to his human system, line 6, giving him dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle. Line 24, that is, over all the constituent elements of the body already digested, already him. He found that life was in spirit only, marginal heading, line 30. Walking in the spirit, in the footsteps of truth, he did not fulfill the lust of the flesh, 223 at the top. His capacity was unfettered, infinite, because, as he learned, he lived in soul, not body, in spirit, not matter. We cannot put the greater into the less, says the paragraph beginning line 7, which is dominated by the terms soul and spirit. In fact, the theme of the whole of Footsteps of Truth is the rolling away of the fetters of a mortal sense of body in order that we may inherit body as it really is, fetterless and free, having unlimited capacities. So, we turn to the subject of world body, line 14. Convulsed as it is today by its search for the answer to the question, what is truth? Not ologies, but science. Accompanied by spiritual rationality and free, unfettered thought, alone can answer this question. Rightly regarded, the marvels, calamities, and sin which abound more and more as truth, little t, urges upon mortals its resisted claims, are the heralds of this science, in the marginal heading. Overturning and destroying sin and foreshadowing the triumph of truth, little t. For the world body, over to 224.2, feels the alterative effect of truth, little t, through every pore. Never must we forget that what really governs the present changes is science, causing us to plant our feet on firmer ground and giving us the choice between painless progress and the self-destruction through suffering of every sensuous pleasure and pain, between life and peace and discord and death. Note how this page teems with references to truth, little t. The question, what is truth, capital T, first put by Pilate to Jesus, is answered by the coming to humanity of its own true manhood, represented by Jesus in the form of truth, little t. So today, a higher and more practical Christianity, line 22, is knocking for admission at the door of human consciousness. Christianity, which is the opposite of sectarian religions, because Christianity is man, the free and unfettered body of Christ, truth, capital T. It is represented in this text as truth, little t. The central sign of which is the cross. Why? Because it demands the laying off, the crucifying of anthropomorphism, or mortals believing and behaving as if They were little gods. True Christianity comes in meekness, when the sun is at its zenith, as the angel came at noonday to the patriarch Abraham. It is truth itself, line 28, bringing the elements of liberty, which are the rights of man. Slavery is abolished, is the motto on its banner which soul has inspired. Its power is the liberating power of love, the power of the divine government, the government of truth, freeing us from belief that we are the fragmented race of Adam, fettered by mortal body, instead of being the unfragmented body of Christ in Christianity. As truth, little t, answers the question, what is truth, capital T, the world will cease its convulsions. In science, the world is made up of truth, little t, faithfully following truth, capital T, that is, of humanity walking in the footsteps of truth. Man is truth, little t, according to his embodiment of right thinking. Page 225, line 16 there. Human power is none other than the might of mind, capital M. Man, the body of divine mind, breathes the omnipotence of divine justice, breaks despotic fetters and abolishes slavery in proportion as this mind is love.